Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
My guest today is A.L. Kennedy, novelist, short story writer and stand-up comic. Her latest story collection, What Becomes, is just out. Its 12 stories tell of one-night stands, marriage breakdown, redundancy, bereavement. The preoccupation that unites all of them, for me, is with the nature of relationships in an increasingly fragmented modern world. Alison, would you agree with that?
Probably. Then again, that's people tend to be concerned with them one way or another. Obviously, the predominant thing is what becomes of the brokenhearted or people who don't have very good relationships with themselves.
Now, several of these stories have been published before, including one about somebody going into a flotation tank in our very own Guardian Review.
Indeed.
How do you go about putting together a collection?
I'll randomly write them and then I'll get four or five and that'll suggest something that binds them together.
But there does seem to me to be a shape to it.
I think they were written slightly more quickly than I normally would because I broke my normal rhythm and I didn't go short story, novel, short story, novel, short story, novel, because I went novel, novel, short story. I'd been waiting to write a lot of them for a long time. So chronologically, they would. It's more like going and doing an album, I think.
But if you look at the ordering that they've turned up in the collection, they start really quite gloomy, and then towards the end, you suddenly have this upwind.
Really?
The penultimate story. Is it penultimate story? Another, which is about a new family forming after the death of a father.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly interpret it as being happy. I mean, obviously, you sit down and you think about the order of them. But then nobody's going to sit and read them all the way through, except for my mum.
Or me. So that's really interesting. So you don't think people sit and read short story collections from beginning to end?
I certainly couldn't guarantee it. I mean, you'd like to think that you kept hold of the reader and they would read them in a fairly short amount of time. And obviously, you have to put them in an order that would reflect somebody doing that. I foisted it on somebody last week and basically just said, read the last one, you'll be interested in that. I don't think you'll like anything else. You just can't tell.
So what sort of person was that? The last one is a sort of waiting for Godot, except for it's waiting for a magician.
It was a magician, so I said, it's got a magician not in it.
Yes, not in it.
You're a magician who isn't in it.
Now, you're probably going to shoot me down in flames about this. I've probably been over, as one of your characters said, one shouldn't overthink. I've probably been overthinking about it. But it did strike me that actually there's sort of a lot of the stories stand in counterpoint with each other. For example, Sympathy, which is about a one-night stand, which one comes into quite judgmental. It's very graphic and you know that it's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. But it's actually quite tender in the end. The living of it is quite tender. And then you have another one which is called Marriage, where this middle-aged couple seem to be affectionate, but actually it's about an abusive marriage.
That certainly will happen. Sometimes it's because, you know, I've dealt with one side of something and psychologically I want to deal with another. That tends to be why some of the protagonists are male and some of them are female. There seems to be a balancing mentally.
So do you write from a very different place when you're doing short stories than when you're doing a novel?
I don't think so. I think everything comes from the same place, really. Short stories tend to be at the more intense end. And I do tend to be just chronologically unable to write them for long periods of time. So they cook and cook and cook. So these days they do come out more of a piece, I think.
Does your publisher groan when you say you think it might be a short story collection next?
If he does, he does it very quietly. No, I mean, Cape have been always very supportive of my doing short stories. And they've put enough money into marketing them that up until now the sales have been equivalent, which is the big thing about short stories. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy that they don't sell. It's because you don't put any effort into letting people know that they're there.
Now, just turning to the sort of more interior side of it, they're quite self-consciously literary and they draw attention to their own literariness. For example, in Story of My Life, a woman who has dental problems draws attention to italics and she says, this is my speaking out loud voice in italics.
Certainly that story does, yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's literary because it's not a very literary story, but she's definitely...
But she's drawing attention to the fact of the written word rather than the spoken word.
Yeah, yeah. That just seemed more appropriate because it's not... I think it's you'd get a slightly too much dissonance if I'd referred to it as being out loud, given that it isn't. And I don't really want you to be having to adjust in that way when you're reading, because basically you are reading.
It's quite grisly, the idea of this woman who, through the story, has virtually all her teeth pulled out.
It's true. Well, you know, I have many teeth, even now, but every now and then I have to vent my own dental distress, so teeth come up quite often.
And then another thing that I've noticed is a preoccupation with cliché that the characters have. They're aware on some level, and it seems that you're aware, that living is about cliché.
Hopefully in a good way. I think a lot of the people are very disappointed in themselves, and part of their disappointment is that they're behaving in a way that is sort of sadly predictable but helpless.
But there's comfort in cliché as well, isn't there?
Yeah, well, you know where you are. All in the same boat. They're trying to find some kind of structure. I think it's a very middle-aged book, you know, if I'd looked at it from outside. They're having crises of a kind which I think you have at a particular age. I don't think they're in their 20s. I think they're in their 30s or in their 40s. They're having that kind of crisis.
So generally, it's not cheerful. Your writing is not cheerful. This has to be said, doesn't it? She says with a giggle. Was that a demonic laugh?
No, I just get cast in such a horrible light. Hopefully it's enjoyable to read, hopefully. But it's about real life, and real life is not a delicious cocktail of puppies and flowers.
However, what I was going to say after saying that it was not cheerful, is it is actually very, there are a lot of them are very funny. And in particular, a story called As God Made Us.
That made, you thought it was funny?
I thought it was hilarious.
Good heavens.
Now that makes me a sort of deviant,
yeah,
doesn't it?
You're slightly more deviant than I thought now.
I wondered if you would possibly read a little bit of it so we just get a sense of it, what it's about.
Yeah, this is a story about people who are amputees. Again, the reality of British life is we have a lot more than we did before we went to war. That's what happens. But the reality is nobody's going to particularly talk about it. So it's partly a story about people not talking about amputees. And it's from the point of view of one of these guys. It's a bunch of soldiers who go off and they swim together. They're not particularly, they haven't come from the same unit, but they've been in the same hospital dealing with having a variety of different amputations. So this is a bit where they're kind of changing in order to get themselves, which is quite complicated, into the pool in order to swim. Obviously, if you're swimming, then you have much more movement if you're without a limb that you're used to having. And they've all got these army-ish nicknames. Gobbler's left leg gone from above the knee, which is called a transfemoral amputation, this allowing him to repeatedly assert a lie that keeps him merry, or relatively so. There are six of them today. Gobbler, Petey, Fezman, Jason, Frank, and Dan. That's two transfemoral, one with a transtibial to match, an elbow disarticulation, a transradial, a double wrist disarticulation. Frank's been hopeless at knitting ever since. And then there's Dan. He's a right foot disarticulation and a right arm transhumeral, roughly halfway between the elbow and the shoulder, the elbow which is not there anymore and the shoulder which is, the elbow which Dan still feels, the elbow which is frequently wet, warm and wet, like it was when he last saw it. This is another variety of repeatedly asserted lie. Here we go then. Where'd you get the trunks from, Fezman? This from Jason, who's hidden by the lockers nearest the exit. Girlfriend. Got the Dillac trunks from his girlfriend, everyone. When they move out for the main event, Jason will be on one side of Petey and Fezman will be on the other. They will cradle him but won't talk about it. They will look mainly straight ahead. They will halt when they get to the footbath and threaten to dip in Petey's arse. This will make them laugh.
Yeah, so there you have it. You've got the mixture of this very medicalised vocabulary and very ribald stuff between the men.
Yeah, well, you've got a kind of, obviously different professions and callings have different vocabulary, and sometimes one will crash into the other, and there's kind of Dan's fairly internalised, close third person coloured with Dan's thought, which is sort of standard narrative voice, and then you've got the way they speak to each other, which is fairly army slangy. Things like Waltie, which is short for Walter Mitty, for people who want to be soldiers but wouldn't ever actually be. And then you've got, obviously, they've come into contact with medical language because they have to understand what they are now and what has happened to them. So they've incorporated medical language.
So tell me about the relationship between your stand-up and your writing.
Again, it's telling stories. Eventually, over time, because I've now been doing it for 5 years or a bit more than that, anything that you do with language feeds back in, and, you know, I was aware that that would happen. You know, interested to see what would happen, but I couldn't actually guarantee what effect it would have.
Do you find actually sitting by yourself writing novels or short stories actually quite hard?
I don't. I think the difficulty is that although it is isolating, it's also not, because emotionally you're very invested and you're concentrating, so it will feel actually as if you've spent the day with a whole bunch of people, which is the terrible thing, which means you could do it endlessly and almost be in your own little matrix. And you have to make an effort. You know, if I'm really into a novel, I have to make an effort to be with at least one living person every day.
I have a friend who's a novelist who said he had to get out of his pyjamas every day and do the washing up before he went to bed.
Yes, that's dressing is good. Dressing is good. And you have to be aware that for an amount of your life you've been practicing something a lot to get good at it. And that means that you have not done other things that other people do. You know, as with musicians and all kinds of people.
You went to drama school?
I was a theatre studies and dramatic arts student, just kind of half-assed pretend drama student. But I was the thing that attracted me about language actually was its immediate effect and its physicality. I liked saying words. I liked the physical effect of words upon me. And then if you say them at people, seeing what happened to, or feeling what happened to them. And that's a lot of why I started writing, weirdly, just because there were so many things about acting that were horrible, frankly. It's a dreadful thing to do. And I ended up writing for actors that I knew, or writing for myself and directing and looking at all the different edges of words. And that's what sort of took me to end up writing, because that seemed to combine all of those things. But, I mean, it's nice to do more kind of out loud stuff. I think it reminds you of actually what you're trying to do.
And at the moment, you're touring with your show?
A little bit. There is a limit to how many shows we can do before we go to Edinburgh if we still want to be eligible for a Fringe First. Not that that is a realistic prospect, but so we can only do six that are kind of paying proper gigs. But yeah, which has been very interesting, because I've been doing a sort of only funny show about writing on and off. I used to do a sort of rambly big version of it that I've been doing for like 10, 15 years, and then a sort of tighter version for the last five or six, actually. But this is the first time I've actually sat down and with the director, and this is, it's actually a script that's a learnt script. It's not a stand-up script where you have bits. It's an actual written. I've got to memorise an hour. But it's very interesting talking about language and writing with audiences at literary festivals, because you just always it's a very interesting conversation. Really.
Mm. So when are you going to be able to sit down to write the next novel? Which I presume it will be a novel next, will it?
The novel is next. I'm researching it now, which is also making me a little bit mad, because I spent all weekend doing that and just getting huge big lumps of research.
What is it? What's the period?
Oh,
what's
I
the?
Can't tell
oh, go on. Give us just a little clue.
It's contemporary. It's not period.
And you had to come down to London to research it.
It's
another clue.
I did. It's not a very good clue, but it is a clue. So the plan is to start writing it in January.
Alison, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.